Welcome to Oncology Today. The use of trastuzumab deruxtecan in patients with HER2-low breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Shanu Modi from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. In addition to this interview program, there's also a corresponding video featuring Dr. Modi's slide presentation. And to begin, I asked her about the efficacy data she presented at the ASCO meeting from the DESTINY-Breast04 trial in patients with HER2-low breast cancer. I always love the T-DXd waterfall plot. I don't know if you commented that much about response rate and duration of response. Could you comment on that and also your clinical experience? You know, it's hard to, particularly in the metastatic setting, get a feel for, and we'll get into this with your cases, but can you talk a little bit about response rate and duration of response?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we like the impressive waterfall plots that we're used to seeing with T-DXd. The response rates are really tremendous. And for the overall population, the response rate was 50%. And it was a little bit even higher, 52%, for the hormone receptor positive subgroup. So we're, and if you compare that to chemotherapy, it was in the range of about 16%. So you see really dramatic shrinkage of the tumor burden in patients on T-DXd therapy. I think this is one of its real advantages. I mean, we all have patients who have big, bulky disease that are in need of a rapid decrease in tumor burden, and this drug really delivers on that. The duration of response, again, for the hormone receptor positive patients, it was roughly around 11 months, just over 10 and a half months, and just over 8 months for the triple negative population. So again, seeing, and this was significantly longer than the chemotherapy arms, of course. So not only do patients have tremendous shrinkage, the benefit from the therapy is very durable.
So, of course, the obvious question is, I guess you would have to compare indirectly to what you see with T-DXd and HER2 positive. Do you see better looking waterfall plots, better response rates indirectly?
I mean, actually, we do. I really think there is a gradient here, you know, with the level of HER2 expression and the activity of this ADC. You know, what we don't know today is what is at that low, what is the lower threshold? We certainly see, I mean, in both the DESTINY-3 trial and the DESTINY-1 trial, the waterfall plot I did show, you know, the response rates in heavily pretreated HER2 positive metastatic patients was about 60%. It was just over 60%. In the DESTINY-Breast03 trial, again, HER2 positive metastatic patients, but less pretreated, the response rate was over 80%. So really, really impressive activity for the HER2 positive patients. And I think we're seeing, you know, a real gradient based on the level of HER2 expression.
So, of course, the issue of the assay obviously is the main issue, or certainly a main issue. I was just kind of flashing on some of the conversations we've had with your colleagues there at Memorial. So, Yelena Janjigian is very interested in T-DXd and HER2 and upper GI cancers and GI in general. Greg Riley in the lung group, of course, interested. And then at the ASCO presentation, Dr. LaRusso was commenting on a number of issues that kind of go outside of just breast cancer. And one thing she brought up, and you hear a lot about this in lung cancer, is HER2 mutant disease. In lung, right. I mean, they want to use it first line there. How often do you see HER2 mutations in breast cancer, and what do we know about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really relevant question. I mean, we are seeing differences between different tumor types and the importance of HER2. In lung cancer, you know, while we don't see the same importance of the level, it seems, of the HER2 expression, but the HER2 mutant population certainly seems to benefit from some of these traditional HER2 targeted therapies. And I think they have really excellent data for T-DXd in the HER2 mutant lung population. we see a lower rate in breast cancer in general. Overall, it's quoted as between 2 or 3%, probably a little bit higher in the metastatic as opposed to the early stage patients, but it's actually a smaller proportion of our patient population. But they have shown some interesting activity for tyrosine kinase inhibitors and ADCs, including trastuzumab deruxtecan, for HER2-mutated breast cancers as well. And there is a big study ongoing. I think one of my colleagues here at Memorial is, in fact, leading that trial. And they're looking at all patients. You know, it's like a basket study for solid tumors with HER2 mutations. And they're testing T-DXd in that population. So we'll have a more definitive point estimate of its benefit for our breast patients, hopefully soon.
Yeah, and I'm curious whether you think T-DXd or HER2 in general is moving towards, you know, a pan-tumor approach. We just saw BRAF approved pan-tumor, dabrafenib, trametinib, you know, whether or not, I had an oncologist the other day presented me two cases of HER2-positive endometrial cancer, one of which responded to T-DXd, clinically very good response. Do you think we're heading, you know, you see HER2, bladder, et cetera. Do you think, yeah, particularly with what we're seeing here, do you think we're heading in that direction for HER2?
Possibly. Honestly, it feels like it. It wasn't the case years ago. I mean, even if, you know, we look in breast cancer, I mean, it really hasn't been up until this new generation of drugs, these really potent and unique ADCs, some of the TKIs, that we're starting to see activity in all kinds of tumors that we've always known have expressed HER2. So it's I think it's really a testament to this new generation of therapies that this could possibly happen, where we approach HER2 agnostic of the cancer.
You know, maybe because we're always doing programs with different parts of oncology and our primary target is the general medical oncologist, sometimes I try to look back macro, because I know they're thinking macro also in terms of a lot of the issues that we're talking about here today, in terms of, you know, for example, going beyond the tumor. But, you know, I was mentioning GI and lung. Of course, there, PD-1 is a huge issue. PD-1 levels, you know, upper GI, they have this big debate about whether they should even treat people with low PD-1 levels. In a weird way, it kind of reminds me a little bit of this evolving conversation with HER2. You mentioned the idea of continuous variable. A lot of these immune predictors seem to, you know, maybe scientifically it's not the same, but clinically it kind of seems similar. Do you think there's an analogy there? And then the other thing I wanted to mention, again, I hear a lot, particularly in lung and GI, is liquid biopsy. I don't hear breast people talking as much about that. How useful is that? They do liquid biopsies all the time. If it drops down, they don't use HER2. I don't see breast people doing that, but you tell me, what about liquid biopsies?
I mean, look, tumor liquid biopsies are an important research tool right now in breast cancer circles. So they're incorporated or they're embedded in almost all the studies that we're doing. And I think what we need to reach is that critical point where it's very clear that we can base our clinical decisions on these tumor biopsies. I mean, there has been recently at least one study reported, not in the HER2 space, but in the hormone receptor space, positive breast cancer space, where they've shown that acting early based on, you know, changes in mutations that we pick up in liquid biopsies, you know, may allow a longer progression-free survival. What we need to prove is that this does have an impact in the overall survival of patients. And so I think we are perhaps in at a different time point than some of the other, our colleagues in other solid tumors, but I hope we will get there as well. They certainly are a valuable tool, and they're non-invasive, which has, you know, obvious advantages for our patients.
So I want to get a little bit into how you see this strategy fitting into the current treatment algorithm, but first a couple other things from the study itself. In terms of safety, one of the things interesting that Sarah Hurvitz brought up in the editorial is I didn't really initially put together the fact that she works with Dennis Slamon and their interest in cardiac, but she mentioned in the editorial, of course, they've always had this issue about trastuzumab, a number of interesting points that I never really thought about with T-DXd related to cardiac toxicity. What was seen there? She pointed out some of these people, of course, HER2 negative, they had anthracyclines in the past. Mm-hmm. They hadn't been vetted through with, you know, trastuzumab, et cetera. Putting it all together, what did you see there? And is it, what do you think about it? Cardiac data.
Yeah, I think those were fair points. I still don't find the level of cardiac toxicity we saw in the trial to be alarming in any way. I mean, in some respects, this was a population of patients that we were testing, the cardiac effects of in a very open way, because most of the HER2 positive studies, those patients have been vetted. They've gone through years of HER2 targeted therapies. We know they're not going to get cardiac toxicity. This population in the HER2 low trial, you know, they at most may have had an anthracycline in the past, and it'll be really interesting as we try and tease that out and look at prior therapies to see, is there a correlation between having an anthracycline and the development of some of the cardiac toxicity. The rates were very low. I mean, 4% incidence of ejection fraction change, 0.5% of congestive heart failure rates. These are very low and very similar to what we have, even lower than what we've traditionally accepted with HER2 targeted therapies. So overall, they're in a range that is comfortable for us to manage, I think, as oncologists. And we may in the future be able to tease out which patients may be at higher risk.
Do you think that it actually has, cardiac toxicity, TDXD?
Well, TDXD is comprised of trastuzumab and chemo. We know trastuzumab has some cardiac toxicity, so it's not surprising to see these low rates.
I guess too, it might be more of an issue if we end up in the adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting, as you were talking about some of these new trials. Right. Another safety issue I wanted to ask you about before we get to interstitial lung disease is sort of chemo side effects. I hear different things, again, different cancer types, et cetera, alopecia, GI, classic chemo toxicity. What was seen in this study? What have you seen clinically and generally? How do you view this issue?
Yeah, great question. I think in general, the first thing is that we didn't notice a big difference in the safety profile for the HER2 low patients versus the HER2 positive breast cancer patients. So that was reassuring. The profile is very similar, and the side effects are predominantly GI, in nature, and bone marrow toxicity. And that's, I think, pretty much what we expect when we use a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor type of chemo. So there are no big surprises in terms of the safety profile. And, generally the bone marrow suppression is lower. In fact, in DESTINY-4, you saw it's much lower than standard chemotherapy. So it's a manageable level of toxicity. Most oncologists very familiar with managing bone marrow suppression. You can use supportive therapies, growth factor support in these patients, and it can work very well. In terms of the GI toxicity, nausea is the number one toxicity, and we see rates over roughly 70%. Most of that is grade 1 and grade 2. And you have to remember, in all of these TDXD studies, prophylactic antiemetics were never mandated. In some of the more recent studies, they are starting to incorporate that, just because we are seeing this reproducibly, that nausea is the main side effect. So at our institution, we automatically give all patients antiemetic prophylaxis before, with their very first dose. So we don't want them to experience nausea. And it's very standard. I think it has, as you might prescribe antiemetics for someone you are giving anthracyclines to. So a long-acting 5-HT3 antagonist, some steroids, and a prescription, for ondansetron, for example, when they go home, is very effective. There is a very small percentage of patients who will have higher grade, like persistent or refractory nausea. And of course, we have multiple different agents and strategies to try. At some point, those patients may warrant dose reductions. And I think, again, that's how we manage toxicities of any nature in our chemotherapy patients. So that would be your next level of defense. Outside of that, look, alopecia, we reported rates between 30, 40, up to 50% in some of the heavily pretreated patient populations. It was interesting to me in the Destiny 3 trial, where patients were less pretreated again, the rates of grade 2 alopecia were 10%. I mean, very, very much lower than what we were expecting. And yes, hair loss is complicated when you've already had 4 or 5 lines of therapy. You may be starting out with a lower baseline level of hair and hair follicles. And so it's always been messy to interpret, but I think the Destiny 3 kind of gave us a real glimpse into the fact that the hair loss may not be as predominant as we thought. There are studies actually right now ongoing looking at scalp cooling with TDXD therapy to see if we can completely mitigate that risk, which would obviously be so important to our patients.
So, of course, a big issue is interstitial lung disease. Can you kind of go back and review what you saw in your study and where we are today with this issue in terms of not only in terms of the frequency, severity, but also the following patients and right now the standard to diagnose and manage this?
Right. A very, very important question. So I mean, look, I think we all know now very well lung toxicity is a potential toxicity of TDXD. We've seen it from the early trials to every trial that we've conducted to date. And the rates have varied, and we've tried to look and see, can we understand, you know, what's different between the trials? And it's difficult when you start to compare between studies, but it usually comes down to the patient population or differences in the patient population. So in more heavily pre-treated studies, you know, we have seen some of the higher rates of high-grade events. And in the less pre-treated studies like Destiny 3, we've seen very low, non-existent grade 5 and grade 4 events, which is, to me, suggestive to some extent of again, the pre-treated nature of the patient population. So maybe this drug will be safe in our early stage patients. That's one thing I take away from this. In general, the rates of overall lung toxicity have been reasonably stable over time, but it's the high grade event rates that have come down as we've gained more experience and knowledge. And there are tools out there today to help investigators or clinicians when they're treating patients as to what to do when they encounter lung toxicity with this drug. And I think that is going to be the key fundamentally to keeping the rates as low as possible. So the first and important thing is just to be educated about this, not just the treating doctors and clinicians, but also the patients, to make sure patients are aware this is an important toxicity, not to be taken lightly or brushed aside or attributed to all sorts of other things, but to report respiratory symptoms to your doctor. And this should really prompt dose interruption. I think that's a real key point here, is if there is any suspicion of lung toxicity, you have to stop therapy or hold therapy and investigate. There are other things patients may have, infections, sometimes it's progression of disease. All of that needs to be separated out because treated obviously very differently. But if you cannot exclude lung toxicity, that means you have to stop therapy. The other key part of this is starting steroids early. And you know, we amended a lot of the trials to allow physicians to use steroids even in grade 0 lung toxicity, meaning asymptomatic, just some inflammation picked up on the CAT scan, to try and expedite the recovery from that inflammation. The grade 0 patients specifically, those with asymptomatic radiographic findings of lung toxicity, are the one group that you can consider re-challenging with TDXD when the inflammation is completely resolved. All other patients with suspected lung toxicity, you really have to permanently discontinue TDXD. And that's the current recommendation. I think in the future, as we maybe understand more about what's happening and the underlying pathophysiology, have a greater understanding, maybe we can, you know, pull back on that recommendation. But for now, it's a real black and white recommendation. I get asked all the time from doctors around the country, sometimes around the world, what to do with cases of lung toxicity. And I, you know, I am pretty black and white with my answer. If you are suspicious and they have symptoms, that's a full stop, permanent discontinuation of the drug. And only in cases where there's full reversibility of stage zero cases can you consider a rechallenge. We do update an interstitial lung disease paper periodically, you know, sort of a pooled analysis of cases. And I think most recently, I think earlier this year, we did the update again, just including more and more patients. It's kind of a mixed group. I mean, it's all tumor types and different doses, et cetera. But we did report for the first time a group of 47 patients with grade zero asymptomatic. Sorry, I keep calling it grade zero. It's grade one. I should clarify that. Grade one lung toxicity, where the 47 patients who had complete resolution of their grade one asymptomatic lung toxicity, 44, I want to say, were fully rechallenged successfully with TDXD. So that's a big, I think, that's the biggest experience, I think, reported to date, showing that in these grade one patients, you can rechallenge safely.
So weird thought, sort of indirectly, how would you compare it to the risk of pneumonitis with everolimus?
I mean, look, we actually see lung toxicity from a number of the therapies we use. Everolimus one for sure. Taxanes, we know, gemcitabine. I mean, we see even CDK4/6 inhibitors are reported to have lung toxicity. The difference with TDXD has been the high grade events, the fatalities.
Right.
And so I think that's different, and that's something that obviously we never want to see happen. So it takes the lung toxicity of TDXD to a different level, and I think that's why we're seeing such, I think, very prescriptive guidelines on what to do when you encounter this toxicity in patients. You know, I think for our other drugs like Taxol, like everolimus, there's a little more, I think, clinical judgment leeway offered in these drugs where, you know, if it's a low-grade toxicity, you can sometimes treat through it. You can manage patients with steroids. I've done it personally with low-grade taxane lung toxicity. I wouldn't do that with TDXD.
Very good information. So I want to kind of get a little bit into the specific algorithm that you currently are envisioning and you think other people are envisioning. We did a satellite meeting at ASCO the day after you presented the data, and I came up with kind of five questions I asked the faculty and the audience. I'm going to kind of run through that with you. One was whether or not it seems like there's a difference between 1+ and 2+. Everybody said it looks the same. Is that your thought?
Yeah, I think we were really not surprised, but impressed to see that both the 2+ and 1+ patients fare pretty similarly. And I don't know if you recall that quantitative graph I put up,
right,
of HER2 expression. The levels in 2+ and 1+ are actually pretty close to each other, you know. So it was interesting. We saw sort of very similar results for those two groups. So I don't know that our pathologists have to expend a lot of time differentiating 1+ versus 2+.
Right. And vis-a-vis our current recent conversation, I also asked the audience and the faculty if they could, would they use TDXD in a patient with breast cancer that had a HER2 mutation? If you could, would you do that? That was like a mixed response. I think about half the people said they would, but you tell me.
I think we have some pretty striking data with TKIs. I would be tempted to use a TKI first. At some point, if without other options, I would definitely be tempted to try. Yes.
That is a good point, though, about the TKIs. So here's the main thing that we asked them, and that really, of course, is that what everybody was asking is about where it fits in the algorithm. So we asked both ER positive and ER negative, so triple negative and ER positive, HER2 negative, but now HER2 low. And we asked about the scenario of a patient with a non-visceral, not very symptomatic disease, and a patient with a lot of diseases, very symptomatic, in terms of where it would fit in the algorithm. So let's start out with ER positive, HER2 low. where theoretically, you know, putting aside regulatory issues, and it'll be interesting how that develops too. I'll be curious of your thoughts on where you think that's heading, but where do you see it fitting in?
So, I mean, I think that that was the biggest population in the Destiny 4 trial was the hormone positive HER2 low patients. And you know, we offered clinicians some leeway there, you know, up to one or two lines of standard chemotherapy. Now, these were all endocrine refractory. So I would always use endocrine therapies to the point where they were no longer effective. I mean, we can't offer better quality of life and more targeted therapy than endocrine therapy for hormone-positive breast cancer. And so that was an eligibility requirement for Destiny 4. So I would still be offering these patients CDK4/6 inhibitors, you know, SERDs, et cetera, to the point where they were now requiring chemotherapy. And in many ways, I can kind of preempt all your questions by saying, I think for me, the difference is in this population is how quickly is the disease progressing, and you know, how symptomatic are patients, what is the burden like, and you know, for the patient with we all have these really indolent, kind of slow growing, we have really some great options, well tolerated options, standard options for these patients like capecitabine chemotherapy. I'd still probably be tempted to use that first. And then I think when we start to hit some of the more toxic chemotherapy options, this is clearly my next choice. For that rapid progressor with big burden of disease or symptomatic disease, I'm reaching for this drug before anything else.
So I'm curious too. I'm kind of starting to think that second line hormonal therapy may be not as effective as I thought it was in the past. Yeah. What about jumping over that?
Yeah, there for sure. You know, I think some of the data we've seen for post CDK4/6 inhibitors is not really reassuring in any way. So I think this is certainly a space where you're going to see the ADCs come in.
So I'm really curious about the triple negative HER2 low patient. I can tell you, I had a pretty spirited discussion at our meeting. Erica Hamilton started out saying, oh, your TDXD data looks awesome, and was talking about that. And Hope Rugo jumped up and was like, what happened to sacituzumab? We have so much more data. I'm sure you're hearing this thing get played out all the time.
Yeah,
so
right,
what
right.
about that?
So, I mean, look for the... I will now be thinking about triple negative patients in two categories. So the triple negative patient that has HER2 low expression and the triple negative patient that has IHC HER2 zero expression. That HER2 zero expression category, triple negative patient population, that's my sacituzumab population. Excuse me, the group that is HER2 low, I'm certainly thinking about TDXD for those triple negative patients. The triple negative group, to be fair, yes, is a smaller group, excuse me, in our study. But the hazard ratios, the confidence intervals, the absolute benefits, the results are pretty striking. And when that group was put in the full total study population, the statistics are robust. So first of all, I think people should feel very confident using this therapy for your HER2 low triple negative breast cancer patients. And in my mind, that's how I'm going to differentiate the two is the HER2 low triple negative. I'm favoring TDXD and those with IHC zero sacituzumab. At some point, these two ADCs may need to be compared head to head. And even considered in sequence. And of course, the one thing I didn't mention is you know, for patients where lung toxicity is a concern, you know, obviously sacituzumab would be the preferred ADC there.
Although, sacituzumab, I think they've seen pneumonitis, right?
Yes.
Not fatal, but I think.
Right. Yes, correct. You're correct. They have also reported a low rate of lung toxicity, but lower than what we see with TDXD and without grade 5 events.
So why don't we finish out with your cases? Also, I would you want to readjust your headset? It seems like it's slipping
a little bit.
Is it,
maybe
makes it more comfortable? Great.
Hey, thank you. Yep.
Make sure you're comfortable. Okay, great. All right, so let's talk a little bit about your cases. Why don't we start out with this first patient? I guess she started out in 1994, age 42. What happened?
Yeah, so this is a lovely patient. She did have breast cancer, as you can see, right-sided breast cancer at a very young age. It was a stage one breast cancer at that time. So it was treated with surgery and radiation, and almost, you know, 20 years later, presented with a second breast cancer on the same side, another right-sided breast cancer. This time, a different breast cancer, lobular, stage two, had involved lymph node, strongly hormone positive, as we expect, and HER2 negative, as we would call them at that time. So she had mastectomy this time. She took chemotherapy. She went on to endocrine therapy and did well. And I'm going to pull up my slide advancer. There we go. But a couple years later, presented with metastatic disease, and it was found because of some other workup, and they found a large kidney on one side. And so the workup eventually led to finding a mass around the ureter on that side, and a biopsy confirmed this was recurrent lobular breast cancer. And we know lobular breast cancer grows in weird places and weird ways. So this is how it presented for her. It was still hormone positive. It was IHC 1, HER2 1 plus, so HER2 negative. We did sequencing, you know, as we were doing at this point in time. So she had some very classic mutations for hormone positive breast cancer, PI3K, ESR1, and an FGFR1 amplification. And at this time, she was not a patient of mine at this point. She was switched, her endocrine therapy was switched to letrozole, which is actually, frankly, very similar to an anastrozole, sort of maybe reflects more the slow-growing nature of her cancer, and she remained on that for several months. And then eventually, with more progression, she went into clinical trial of an FGFR inhibitor, sort of trying to capitalize on the amplification that was seen. She did undergo a repeat biopsy before starting this trial, still hormone positive, but at this time, it was no longer HER2 amplified breast cancer. Had 2+, but not amplified. Went on to this therapy, didn't last for too long. She then went on to a second clinical trial, this time trying to target the PI3 kinase mutation. So fulvestrant plus a PI3 kinase inhibitor, again, lasted for a brief period of time. And then she sort of presented to me, interested in the phase one TDXD trial, which is what we had open at the time. And so she was randomized, or not randomized. Well, there was a small randomization to dose at the time. She got onto what is today the standard dose, 5.4 milligrams per kilogram. And literally within two doses of having the therapy, we started to see her cancer melt, shrink. And she went on to stay on this therapy for almost 13 months, a little bit over a year. She had at one point on her scans near complete resolution. And she had at the time of the starting study, a lot of peritoneal involvement. So I have some CT scans here. These are her baseline scan on the left. It's sort of hard to see peritoneal disease well, but I left the radiologist markers on, and you can start to see how the numbers get smaller. And on this scan as well, serially, you can see that about 3 or 4 months into from July up, I think, until the January scan, I should say, she almost had complete resolution of all her peritoneal disease on CAT scan. So really tremendous response. She was tolerating the therapy extremely well, was so pleased. This allowed her and her husband to do traveling, and it's something they both enjoyed doing. And, you know, things remained well up until, as I said, about 13 months into therapy. At that point, a scan did start to show some evidence of the peritoneal disease reaccumulating. And she did do a biopsy and came off study at that point. It was interesting. The tumor had now gone from 2+ HER2 down to HER2 0, but was still ER positive. And so she's actually like a classic patient on the Destiny 4 trial, although she was on the phase 1 study that predated that. But, you know, she got almost 13 months of disease control. And prior to that was sort of cycling through, you know, targeted therapies every couple of months.
You know, I was thinking, first of all, any evidence that lobular responds any different than ductal?
I mean, I don't have that data to say that there's a difference based on histology. I mean, that's something we could we'd certainly go back and look at. It's an interesting point. I think prognostically or in general, we see a little bit more lobular breast cancer in the HER2-low population. But that's something we haven't specifically looked at in the trial.
Interesting. You know, what do we know about HER2 in normal cells?
I mean, look, it's one of our normal genes, right? The HER2 genes. And epithelial cells do express HER2. So it is a normal protein on normal epithelial cells. It's just, you know, that small group of 15% to 20% of breast cancer patients where it's kind of hijacked. And we start to see, you know, 100-fold, 1,000-fold more expression levels of this protein where we're able to target it, or what we call HER2-positive breast cancer. But it is a normal protein, a normal gene in our epithelial cells.
I mean, but meanwhile, you have a patient who's got a HER2-1 plus, maybe even HER2-0, and they respond. So I guess I'm thinking, well, why doesn't their bone marrow get destroyed? But maybe the tumor is more sensitive? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is HER2-0 at the time she's coming off the trial. You know, when she started, right, she had 2+ expression.
But I mean, in general, you know.
Yeah, in general, I think this kind of your point comes back to this issue of, you know, IHC was never meant to be a quantitative assessment of HER2 expression, and we're kind of using it that way. And look, it does work to a point here. I think that's been proven in Destiny-4, but it's really not sensitive at these lower levels or at the lower end of the HER2 expression spectrum. And this is where a quantitative assay could be really helpful in identifying, you know, what is the threshold we need to activate the ADC.
All right, let's hear about your second patient, the 28-year-old woman.
Yeah, this is another really lovely patient. She had a strong family history of breast cancer. Did palpate a lump very young when this was discovered. Was immediately worked up, biopsy. This was triple positive breast cancer, so hormone positive, HER2 positive. And thankfully nothing anywhere else. Lymph nodes appeared negative. So she did go on to have surgery. She elected to have bilateral surgeries, just given her strong family history. It made good sense, even though there was no genetic mutation. And so that, you know, this was a 2.2 centimeter node negative, triple positive breast cancer. So she was offered, you know, standard therapy at this time back in 2007. We were using single agent trastuzumab for a year plus polychemotherapy. So she was offered what we would standardly use, which is ACT plus the year of trastuzumab. She was also offered a clinical trial. So at that time, we were doing an ALTO type study here at Memorial, incorporating lapatinib plus trastuzumab for a year. She actually ended up declining that. She was concerned about some of the toxicities of lapatinib. So took standard therapy, completed that, went on to endocrine therapy, of course, tamoxifen, and then surveillance, and was sort of minding her own business. A few years later, unfortunately, there was evidence of recurrence. And it was a low burden. You can see she had very few lymph nodes and some very, very tiny lung metastases developing. We were only able to do a fine needle of one of the lymph nodes, and it did confirm this was recurrent breast cancer. It was still hormone positive. There was not enough tissue to do HER2 testing. But just knowing that she was a HER2 positive patient in the beginning, she was treated as per HER2 positive recurrence. So first line, she got the Cleopatra regimen. 5 months later, her PET scan complete remission, metabolic remission. So we stopped the taxane, and she was maintained on the Herceptin and the Perjeta, or trastuzumab and Perjeta, pertuzumab, sorry, and did well on the maintenance therapy for a few years, but presented again with a sort of a relapse in the same original sites. So a little bit of nodal disease, some lung metastases. And I think just given how her case had evolved, and it was still the same sites that started to get brighter again on the PET scan, it was decided maybe she would be a good candidate for sort of aggressive local therapy. So she went to the OR, had the lung and the lymph nodes resected. And you can see here, you know, there was 4 lymph nodes involved, a small lung nodule. And this was still hormone positive. But now it was a 2+ IHC and FISH non-amplified. So she went from being HER2 positive to technically HER2 negative using, you know, our current nomenclature. Again, sequencing showed a PI3K mutation. By virtue of having her disease removed, she was without evidence of any cancer on scans, what we call NED. And so at that time, it was felt to continue the at least the HP maintenance therapy, as it was working everywhere else, and add in good endocrine therapy. So she went into an AI and ovarian suppression. And that did well, but 5 months later, she had recurrence again, frustrating in lymph nodes, and this time a liver metastasis. So, at this point, it was decided to switch to another line of HER2 targeted therapy. She went on to T-DM1. She actually did have a reasonable initial response, but 6 months later, more growth, more mediastinal nodes. A repeat biopsy was done at this point, still hormone positive and still HER2 non-amplified. At this point, she was able to still qualify for a clinical trial. This was directed at the PI3K mutation, so she went into a PI3K plus HER2 targeted therapy study. Had a bit of benefit to that with that 10 months. Then some more progression in the lymph nodes, a repeat biopsy done, still the same profile, was able to qualify for another trial. This time the CDK4/6 inhibitors were entering the world, so she got onto a CDK4/6 inhibitor, endocrine therapy, HER2 targeted therapy trial, and again, a little bit of benefit. But, you know, now at this point, she's starting to have more bulky disease, big lymph node involvement, and she had a solitary CNS metastasis. So she had an ablation to that, and then after the proper washout, we enrolled her into our phase 1 TDXD trial. So she actually got to enroll on a study for HER2 low metastatic breast cancer again. Although you recall, she was HER2 positive at one point in the past. And those kinds of patients, there was a small percentage of those types of patients that did end up enrolling onto the phase 1 TDXD trial for HER2 low breast cancer. She started off, she was randomized to the higher dose. She got 6.4 milligrams per kilogram. She had excellent tolerability and she had complete regression of her disease. In fact, she had complete regression for 5 years. She's one of the longest patients I've taken care of on one of the TDXD trials. So she, her top scans were the baseline, the bottom. There's not a lot to see there. You know, she had tremendous response to the therapy. Unfortunately, her site of progression after those 5 years was another brain lesion. She presented with headaches and visual disturbance. It was a small solitary spot. Again, she got some radiation. Localized radiation to that. And unfortunately, it took her off the study. But at this point, TDXD was now commercially available in the U.S. So we were able to keep her on TDXD therapy now at the lower dose, the approved dose, 5.4 milligrams per kilogram. And she's been doing fine on that systemically as well. It's been about a year, I think, now. And she's doing well. So another really, I think it's a mixed kind of a picture. She would not have been eligible for the DESTINY-4 trial because they really tried to exclude these heterogeneous cases where there's some HER2 positive, some HER2 low. But she was able to make it onto the phase 1 trial. A great story.
Wow,
I still take care of her today. Yeah, yeah.
Unbelievable. You know, as you were going through that case, I was flashed. I don't know if you know, there's a investigator in lung cancer, Ross Kamage at the University of Colorado. We were doing a webinar with him a few weeks ago. He was talking about this idea of the time capsule, that if you can just push a patient ahead, by the time they get there, maybe there's going to be something else. And I noticed that she started out in 2007 getting adjuvant trastuzumab, which is right after 2005. And since that time, she's kind of getting bumped along. It almost sounds like I've heard stories like that in myeloma. As new things, you know, they keep people going and then they add in new drugs. So, wow, what a story.
Yeah, Anyhow, I, I agree. I keep telling these kinds of patients, just hang in there. There's something else coming. I know it. Just hang in there. And she's truly a testament to that.
But what an incredible human story. But, you know, it also brings up the issue. I'm always talking to the GI and lung people and saying, will you all repeat HER2? And if it goes from plus to negative, then you stop using HER2. But I don't know if the breast cancer people do that. If they start out clearly HER2 positive, they go in on a 2+. They don't stop giving, I think. So a patient like this kind of doesn't fit, I would say, kind of a typical paradigm. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have seen that, or there is this paradigm in breast cancer that once you're positive, you're always positive. And maybe there's heterogeneity and you know, we don't want to miss an opportunity to give someone life-prolonging therapy. And we've done the trials in breast cancer where we've shown that continuing the HER2-targeted therapy offers clinical advantage for these patients. So, you know, we have, as you saw in this last case, we've tended to be conservative and continue to offer the therapy. And now we're in an era where some of these new drugs like TDXC, they get rid of the whole problem of HER2 heterogeneity for us. You know, they sort of bypass it. She's been very fortunate to be able to stay ahead of her disease with the new and exciting therapies that have come along.
Although I have heard cases presented to me of people who start out HER2 positive, then they get HER2 low, and maybe they, before your data came out, they were leaning towards TDXD over, say, tucatinib, as an example. I don't know if that's logical or not, but I mean, I guess if you ran out of options, if the patient progressed on TDXD and they were originally HER2 positive, would you try tucatinib if they became, or, you know, some other HER2 strategy if they became HER2 low?
When we're desperate and we're looking for anything to help, I think it's worth trying, especially in with drugs like tucatinib that don't have a lot of toxicity and there is potential for benefit. So I think that's, putting on my clinician's hat, that's probably what I would say.
So let's talk about this third patient, the 39-year-old patient.
Right. So this is, again, another lovely favorite patient of mine, young woman, teacher, years ago, cleaning the blackboard, she felt something under the armpit, and that's what led to the whole workup, ultimately diagnosed with a pretty more, you know, a more locally advanced breast cancer, unfortunately, hormone positive, HER2 negative, or 1+, as you can see, it was a large tumor, lots of lymph nodes. So after her surgery, She had standard chemotherapy, went on to endocrine therapy, and a few years later was actually being worked up for a hysterectomy for heavy vaginal bleeding, and it was just a pre-op chest X-ray that picked up lung nodules. I mean, these are the kind of cases we present to medical students. And sure enough, you know, she had a small needle biopsy, and this was a recurrence of her breast cancer, unfortunately. It was still hormone positive. Not enough tissue to test again for HER2. Go to the next slide. So not enough tissue to test for the HER2 again, but she was HER2 negative. And so we treated her along the algorithm for hormone positive metastatic breast cancer. So at that time, she switched from tamoxifen to a first line aromatase inhibitor. She had some slight progression, and we ended up enrolling her onto a trial of a PI3 kinase inhibitor plus AI therapy, which was open at our site. I failed to mention she also had a PI3 kinase mutation detected. She did well with that actually for a number of years, and then some more progression in the lung. And she was very, in some ways similar to the last case, where the disease was very localized to the same area in the lung. So again, it made sense maybe to target that more aggressively. So she had a lung resection, and they removed the area where she continued to have the recurrence, and it was hormone positive. And this time we had the tissue to test. It was HER2 3+. So now we sort of switched her to the HER2 algorithm pathway. And so, again, she's rendered NED by the surgery. So we put her on endocrine, a different endocrine therapy, fulvestrant, plus trastuzumab. She went on to have a CDK4/6 inhibitor with the trastuzumab. At some point, we had to go to the Cleopatra regimen and then T-DM1. So she started to fall, you know, go through sequentially our treatment algorithm for HER2-positive breast cancer. Eventually, progressed through T-DM1, and at this time, the PET scan there shows you she had lymph nodes, she had lung mets, and she actually was able to enroll into the DESTINY-Breast01 trial, which was our phase 2 study of T-DXd, which was the real registration study for T-DXd in HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. And she did great. I mean, she went on to the 5.4 standard dose, had a major response. Again, it happens very quickly in these patients after 2 cycles. But unfortunately, 5 months into therapy, developed evidence of inflammation on her CT scan in the lungs. So suspicion for pneumonitis. And this was tragic, of course, because she's in a great remission. She's asymptomatic. No symptoms at all. So we held the therapy, did a big workup, got our lung docs involved, etc. She was started on steroids. And had actually resolution of those findings. It took almost 2 months for the scans to clear, but we were able to resume her on T-DXd on a lower dose as per the protocol. And she did well. She stayed on it for another 4 months before eventually having progression of disease, at which point she officially came off the study. So it's a good case to sort of illustrate the issue of lung toxicity and the potential for reversibility and rechallenge in just those grade 1 cases.
So kind of a follow-up, how do you think through patients who do progress on T-DXd, particularly these HER2-low patients? I know you mentioned other antibody-drug conjugates. Anything exciting out there that you're trying to steer your patients towards?
I mean, when we have the opportunity, we want to enroll them onto clinical trials. And there is a whole new generation of other HER2 antibody drug conjugates specifically that are active in HER2 low breast cancer and HER2 positive breast cancer, of course. And so we do have a trial at our institution for breast cancer specifically. And then we have a bunch of phase 1 trials of new ADCs, some of them with non-chemotherapy payloads, but IO payloads. And so we try and steer patients whenever we can into a new and exciting sort of experimental therapy. Outside of that, for most of these patients, you know, we are limited often to chemotherapy, and it's usually single agent sequential chemotherapy at this point. And I will say, at least we have a large, I think, group of drugs to choose from, most of which are fairly well tolerated.
So I'm always joking that every day I hear things I've never heard before that are just amazing. You just said something that really shocked me. Just payload of an IO. Antibody drug conjugates, it's not chemo? Yeah. Really?
Yes. So there are some new drugs in development where, I mean, we have payloads that are radioisotopes, so they're radiation.
Sure.
Phase 1 study of that. And currently there's a phase 1 where the payload is a toll receptor target. TLR
wow.
target, so an immune-based target. So we're seeing exciting things happen with this technology, and we may see more than just chemotherapy payloads being active in the future.
Well, that is really fascinating. So one final question. I've been calling this last 6 months or a year like antibody-drug conjugate year. I mean, there's so many things happen. We had first-line therapy, diffuse large B cells, not getting antibody-drug conjugate. Polatuzumab, myeloma, they got belantamab, BCMA, cervical cancer had tisotumab approved. There are 2 antibody drug conjugates approved in bladder cancer now. So just kind of curious, I remember before the checkpoint inhibitors came along, there was so much excitement about ADCs, and then it seemed like then everybody was just talking about immunotherapy, and now seems like ADCs are coming together. Any thoughts about where this is heading? And another thing is really that combination, you know, antibody-drug conjugate with IO, again, bladder cancer, they're all excited about, enfortumab and pembrolizumab. Any thoughts in general about where you see this strategy heading and sort of melding into the mainstream of oncology research?
Yeah, I mean, it is really an era of ADCs that we're in. And I mean, it's just because of the technological advances that have been made with these compounds and these linkers and the payloads. And look, I think one of the exciting things that the DESTINY-Breast04 trial specifically showed us is we can maybe go after targets we didn't think we could before. You know, these low-level expressing targets. So I think that has certainly opened up a whole avenue of research. So that's really exciting. Of course, the other thing, of course, is, yes, these novel payloads and combinations. I mean, you know, one of the things we'd really like to do with the DESTINY-4 data is to look and see. I mean, there are some people who respond so well, and then there are others that don't really get the same benefit. What's different about those cases, and what can we do to get their response up to the level of the responders? And it's going to likely require combinations. You know, there are many studies underway and even more coming, combining ADCs with IO therapy. Remember, ADCs, they also include an antibody therapy, and so many ways to try and maximize the immune potential with these combinations. The Begonia trial is probably, in my mind, one of the exciting studies. And for breast cancer circles in particular, the checkpoint inhibitors have really had the greatest inroads in triple negative breast cancer. And so trying to build on that, the Begonia trial, they're looking at different ADCs in combination with checkpoint inhibitors. And we're seeing some very exciting results. And importantly, we're not seeing a worsening of the lung toxicity, which of course is sort of always on the back of the mind. You see pneumonitis with IO therapy, you see it with TDXC, but we're not seeing that play out as prohibitive in these trials. So I think stay tuned. There's still so much ahead. I really, really think we're really just at the beginning of exploiting ADC therapy for cancer.
So a couple more questions. Like, we could probably go on all day. I'm sure you get questions all the time, but a couple others. One is, I know obviously there's a lot of interest and there's a trial and probably more than one trial looking at post-neoadjuvant TDXD versus T-DM1 in the HER2 positive situation. Curious if you have any predictions about what that's going to show and whether there are any situations where you try to do that outside of protocol now.
The last question I can answer easily, and that's no. You know, we're not using TDXD in the early stage patients outside of studies. I think we're a conservative profession, and I think we really want to see the safety. That's a potentially curable population, so we want to make sure everything we're doing is safe. So I wouldn't treat a patient outside of a trial in that scenario. My prediction, I mean, look, I honestly think TDXD is going to be a clear winner in that trial. For me, the question is not, you know, which is going to be the winner. My question is really going to be, how much do we actually have to give these patients? Do we really need this 14-cycle therapy? It's somewhat arbitrary. And I think this is where, coming back to your point earlier about liquid biopsies or ctDNA, frankly, maybe a way to design, I think, more I think creative studies as to how much is enough, because that's an equally important question. But my guess is that we're going to see a very clear winner in that trial, and it's probably going to be TDXD.
So I'll force myself to only ask you one more question. I was going to ask you this before. You were presenting the patient who had a strong family history of breast cancer, and it kind of triggered me. And that was she was diagnosed a while back, et cetera. But I was curious whether there's any difference in responsiveness to TDXD based on sort of, I don't know, DNA repair biology. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily think that would be the case, but everybody's getting tested nowadays. So I'm just kind of curious, is there any correlation? But it is chemotherapy, but I would assume there's no correlation, right? But I don't know if it's been studied.
I mean, I can't say I have any data. We had a small population of BRCA patients on the trial, and we may go back and see if there's any differential benefit. I mean, they are predisposed based on their genetic defect to be susceptible to certain kinds of chemo. And topoisomerase 1 inhibitors, which is the payload in TDXD, you know, is one of those chemos potentially that could be more active in that setting, in that population of patients. So it's a great research question. And I think you may actually see studies addressing that in the future.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Modi, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.